years out. I like to invest in companies that are cheap relative to their sector, but where we are forecasting earnings above consensus for the next few years. The catalyst I monitor for a stock to realize value is earnings surprise. In the case of Apple, we are forecasting earnings 50 or 60% above the street for the next 3 or 4 years. Although Apple is currently trading at 16 times forward prospective earnings for 2011, based on our forecasted level of earnings for 2014, it is only trading at 4.8 times earnings. Apple is one of the fastest growing companies in the world, with one of the best management teams, trading at less than 5 times earnings based on our future earnings projections, and with $150 billion net cash by 2014, which is nearly half of its market cap. We currently have 20% of our portfolio in Apple. Given all those bullish fundamentals, why hasn't Apple performed better? One reason it is not performing at the moment is because it has gone up a lot, so investors think they can't buy it. But the main reason is that all that the analysts in the U.S. seem to be focused on is that the next iPhone may be delayed for a few months. They think that is bad. It is not bad at all. The reason Apple is so brilliant is because their execution is outstanding. Would they prefer if Apple came out with their next iPhone version early and did what RIMM, Research in Motion Limited, has done with the Playbook, the new tablet they have for the BlackBerry, which is one of the most suicidal pieces of rubbish ever put out? RIMM will probably go bust in the next 3 or 4 years. Why is that? Because they keep on having incompetent product launches. For example, they're bringing out a new tablet, and you can't even use it for email. And this is a product that is targeted for the corporate market? That is like producing a car with no engine or wheels. It is literally as bad as that. It shouldn't have come out for at least another year. The reason they rushed it to market, even though it is not ready, is that the Apple iPad 2 is such a big advance that it has helped Apple break into the corporate market. Now business people are saying, I don't want my BlackBerry phone anymore. I want an iPhone. RIMM was worried that if they didn't come out with competition for the iPad 2, they would lose the corporate market. But what they have done is guarantee that they will lose the corporate market by undermining every company IT manager who has argued for maintaining the BlackBerry over the iPhone. What RIMM has done is taken a knife and driven it through the heart of their business. I interviewed Taylor on April 30, 2011. On the previous day, Apple had closed at $350 and RIMM at $49. By the time I was proofing this text in the production process less than 10 months later, February 19, 2012, Apple was at $502 and RIMM at $15. How do you pick shorts? Shorts are more difficult. On the long side, I like companies that are cheap relative to their sector, but where I expect positive earnings surprises during the next few years. So turning that around, ideally, I would like to go short companies that are expensive relative to their sector and where I expect profit warnings over the next few years. The problem is that these bad companies have the greatest risk of being takeover targets. The emerging markets are full of sectors where multinationals want exposure. And the only companies they can generally take over are bad companies. In emerging markets, in order to take over a company, you need to triangulate between the company, the government, and the regulator. It is much more difficult for a foreign firm to get government or regulator approval for a takeover of a local company that is doing well, or about to do well, because the authorities will fear being seen as selling out to foreigners. Whereas, if it is a bad company, the government and regulators are much more likely to approve the acquisition, because it will be seen as saving the company and saving jobs. You can be long a good stock at 7 times earnings, and short a bad stock at 15 times earnings, and some stupid foreign company comes along and pays a 50% premium to buy the bad company. So how do you walk that tightrope when the companies you most want to short are the ones most vulnerable to a takeover? Half to three quarters of our shorts are stock index futures, so most of our net exposure adjustment is done through shorting markets rather than individual companies. How do you manage the shorts that are individual companies given the takeover dilemma you detailed? We only short bad companies that can't be taken over because they are owned by the government or their own pension fund. If the company is owned by the pension fund, It will never be sold because the workers will be afraid that the acquiring company would sack 20% of the labor force.
What percent of companies are owned by the government or pension funds?
In emerging markets, about one-third of all companies are government or pension fund owned.
What is your risk control process?
We are always in the most liquid securities. If we get it wrong, we get out immediately. We do a lot of research before we put on any trade. Not only do we forecast the earnings for a stock 3 or 4 years out, we also forecast the macro picture 3 or 4 years out as well.
Can you really forecast that far out?
Our macro views change quite regularly. You just have to be pragmatic. When you get it wrong, you need to get out immediately. I am wrong all the time, if I can be right 60% of the time. And when I am right, I have some big winners. And when I am wrong, I staunch the losses quickly. I can make a lot of money.
Do you have any specific risk control rules?
We have never had and would never use any form of quantitative risk control because all quantitative risk control models use historical volatility. It is like driving by looking in the rearview mirror. If you use volatility as a guideline, and volatility suddenly increases, you will don't find that your risk was much greater than you thought, but by then you will already have been wiped out. That is exactly what happened to a lot of our managers in 2008. We also never used stops.
So what do you do to manage risk instead?
It is common sense. There are multiple requirements for a trade to take place. Do we like the company? Is it cheap? Does it generate cash flow? Do we trust the management? Do I have confidence in my projections? Is the macro outlook favorable? If a company meets all the criteria, then the next step is determining the appropriate position size. Given the degree of company and country risk, what do I think is the appropriate size position? If it is something very risky, a large position for me might be 1% to 5% of the portfolio. If it is a lower risk position in which I have very high confidence, the position could be as large as 20% of the portfolio, as is currently the case for Apple. I accept that if anything were to happen to Steve Jobs, the stock could go down 10%. That would be a 2% hit on my portfolio. I could live with that because I think the stock will triple over the next 4 years. If I have that big of a position in Apple, can I have another significant position in the same industry sector? No, I can't because a negative shock event or development might be one that impacts the entire sector rather than being Apple-specific. In controlling risk, it is also very important to have people in your team whose opinions you respect, who can push back at your ideas in a way that will make you stop, listen, and test your own views. My partner, Nick Barnes, is crucial to me in this regard.
Is there any common denominator as to why your projections for a stock will differ from the market's perception?
Normally, it is because there is some kind of trend that I think is common sense, but that the market does not appreciate because it is extrapolating history instead of looking forward. For example, Apple has never had any consequential sales in India or China, so the street assumption is that they never will, which is imbecilic. As another example, during the fourth quarter of last year, Apple sold 7.3 million iPads. The average street forecast for iPad sales this year is 29.5 million units. All they have done is take fourth quarter sales of last year and annualize them. What they are failing to take into account is that Apple has revolutionized an existing product that was already way ahead of any competitor. Not only is it a much better product, but Steve Jobs decided to price it competitively instead of at a premium. Given Apple's economies of scale, no one else can even possibly compete. So we think they will sell 40 million iPads this year and 60 million next year. The street's forecast for next year is 40 million. It is not rocket science. It is just common sense.
Everything we have talked about has involved fundamental analysis. Does that imply that you don't use technical analysis at all?
Oh, no. Charts are very important. Once I have done the fundamental work and decided to buy a stock, I will first look at the chart before putting on a position. If the stock is very overbought, it won't stop me from buying, but I will start with a small position because there is a larger chance of a correction. If instead I put on the entire position and then the stock had a large correction, I would feel terrible. Say I really like a company and want to put 10% of the portfolio in it. If the stock is extremely overbought, then I might start with only a 1% position. If the stock just keeps on going up, then I am happy that I bought at least some. I will also be more willing to buy more because I bought part of the position at a lower price. Whereas if I didn't initially buy anything because the stock was overbought, I would then never buy any of it, which would be a dreadful mistake. Equally important, if I decide to buy a stock based on fundamentals and then look at the chart to see that it has massively underperformed relative to the market, I will check who has been selling the stock. Such price weaknesses may indicate that all our fundamental research is worthless because management has lied to us. I also use charts as an aid to adding to positions. If I am bullish on a stock, but don't have a full position, and then the stock breaks out on the chart, I will then go to a full position because the breakout confirms that the market is now seeing the same thing I am seeing.
So you're basically using charts as a supplemental tool?
Yes, the core is always fundamental. There is, however, one exception where a trade might be initiated because of charts. If a stock is extremely oversold, say the RSI is at a 3-year low, it will get me to take a closer look at it. Normally, if a stock is that brutalized, it means that whatever is killing it is probably already in the price. RSI doesn't work as an overbought indicator because stocks can remain overbought for a very long time. But a stock being extremely oversold is usually an acute phenomenon that lasts for only a few weeks.
So you're saying that RSI is only useful in one direction?
Correct, which is oversold. If the RSI is extremely oversold, I will then look at the fundamentals to see if whatever has caused the stock to be sold off that sharply is already discounted by the price. If it is, then I will buy.
Is your approach totally analysis-driven, or does gut feel ever play a role?
Gut feel is actually crucial. If something isn't acting right, it is an indication that you need to go back and recheck the fundamentals. I currently have a partial short position in the IBEX, the Spanish stock market. I was thinking of substantially increasing my position. Then yesterday, several economic statistics were released. They were all awful, but the market went up, so I scurried away.
You covered your position?
No, I just didn't add to it because the algorithmic funds were clearly still in control of the market. It would be insane for me to have a large position because I could get destroyed before the market turns down. I have to wait before I short Spain aggressively. My gut feel was, ugh, this is not acting right. But I'm not going to cover my partial position because fundamentally I still think I am right.
What advice would you give to stock investors?
You have to be an expert in what you invest in. You need to understand why you are invested. If you don't understand why you are in a trade, you won't understand when it is the right time to sell, which means you will only sell when the price action scares you. Most of the time when the price action scares you, it's a buying opportunity, not a sell indicator.
What do you consider the worst trading mistake of your career?
My biggest mistake or pattern of mistakes was the way I traded the 2009 market.
I thought you had a big up year in 2009.
I was up 32% for the year, but I should have been up at least 45 to 50%. I am usually very good at riding big beta rallies. My failure to do so in 2009 caused me great angst at the time.
Why did you trade differently in 2009?
Normally, I let winners run and cut losers. In 2009, however, as a result of the post-traumatic effects of going through the September 2008 to February 2009 period, talking to clients who are going out of business and seeing 50% of your fund redeemed is all very wearing. I got into the habit of snatching quick 10 to 15% profits in individual positions. Most of these positions then went up another 35 to 40%. I consider my pattern of taking quick profits in 2009 a dreadful error that I think came about because I had lost a degree of confidence due to experiencing my first down year in 2008, even though the loss was consistent with the expected loss given the magnitude of the market decline. I was constantly worried that markets were about to turn down again, particularly in regards to all the new investors who came into the fund in the second quarter of 2009. I was painfully aware that these new investors did not have the cushion of my previous cumulative gains, and I worried about losing money for them. I was also more aware of my size in the market, as volumes did not recover to anywhere near pre-crisis levels, whereas the fund size was back to pre-crisis size by July 2009. I was concerned about being able to exit in a hurry if necessary. Basically, all these things made my trading more short-term and hair-trigger, which is absolutely not my style. Normally, if I like something, I stick with it. I only stopped this damaging pattern in mid-2010, after I had given investors 12-month notice in March that the hedge fund was closing. This action had an immediate impact in reducing the size of the fund, as redemptions came through steadily. Also, by allowing and encouraging all investors, old and new, to exit at a high watermark, it made me feel that I had done right by all of them. After this point, I relaxed and returned to my former investment style.
In selecting emerging market equities, Taylor looks for three essential characteristics. 1. Favorable macro outlook. There are two key ways in which Taylor's macro assessment will influence the portfolio. First, Taylor will concentrate long in countries with the most positive fundamentals. Second, the global macro outlook can influence the total portfolio net exposure. For example, in late 2008 to early 2009, the very negative global macro fundamentals kept net exposure significantly lower than it would have been based solely on the individual company fundamentals. 2. Supportive secular trend. Taylor looks for situations in which there is a strong fundamentally based secular trend that supports the trade. For example, the strong trend in increasing Russian mobile phone usage in the early 2000s was a key consideration that prompted Taylor to place a large and very profitable position in companies in this sector. As another example, Taylor's expectation that Apple's global market share of its products will trend steadily higher in coming years was the dominant reason why Apple was his largest holding at the time of this interview, April 2011. 3. Good company. Taylor looks for companies with attractive growth prospects priced at reasonable values relative to future expected earnings. He avoids what he calls boring companies, typically low beta stocks, regardless of whether they are at good values. Investors often miss the best stocks because they can't bring themselves to buy a stock that has already gone up a lot. What matters is not how much a stock has gone up, but rather how well a stock is priced relative to its future prospects. Taylor's largest holding at the time of our interview, Apple, had already experienced a very large price advance, and indeed it was the magnitude of this prior rise that kept many investors from buying the stock, despite its excellent fundamentals. As Taylor viewed it, however, the amount of the prior price gain was irrelevant, because based on his earnings projections for Apple, the stock was actually very cheap, notwithstanding its seemingly lofty price. It is important that your net exposure match your comfort level. For example, if you are uncomfortable being completely out of the market, then a flat position may actually be riskier than a modest long position, because you will be much more likely to chase false rallies and get whipsawed. Taylor believes that having some long exposure during the highly volatile late 2008 to early 2009 period actually reduced his potential losses, even though the market declined. He reasons that if he had been out of the market completely, he would have been prone to being whipsawed by one or more of the period's false rallies, potentially losing more than he did with his modest net long exposure. The moral is that you have to know your net exposure comfort zone. For Taylor, the low end of this comfort zone is 20% net long. As another example of the benefits of trading within a net exposure comfort zone, a smaller net exposure may yield better returns, even if the market moves higher. For example, although the market eventually rose to higher levels, by sharply reducing his net long exposure in early January 2008, Taylor was in a position to increase his long exposure following the price plunge later in that month. If he had stayed heavily net long, he might well have been forced to sell into the market weakness to reduce risk. The difference between being a buyer on market weakness instead of a potential seller more than offset the reduced returns implied by a lower net exposure for the period as a whole. Although trying to tightly constrain monthly losses may seem like a prudent approach, and indeed is for many traders, for investors with a long-term perspective, a constraint of keeping monthly losses below some moderate threshold could be detrimental. Taylor believes that an obsession with monthly returns can adversely influence long-term investment decisions. If he is strongly convinced that a stock will move much higher over the long term, then in his view, cutting exposure on interim weakness to limit the depth of a monthly loss would be a mistake.
Freeing himself from what he calls the tyranny of a monthly return focus was one of the main motivations behind Taylor's decision to return investor assets and restructure as a much smaller fund. In my experience, it is usually a mistake for a manager to alter his investment decisions or investment process to better fit investor demands. Taylor acknowledges the same perspective when he states, "I am trying to stop caring about what my clients think." Taylor believes the best opportunities are those where you can identify a potential trend that the market does not appreciate because it is extrapolating history instead of looking forward. For example, Taylor anticipates that a growing global market share will result in Apple's sales far exceeding prevailing projections. Therefore, whereas Apple seemed adequately priced based on current earnings, a forward perspective PE of 16 at the same time of the interview, it was screamingly cheap based on Taylor's estimate of earnings 3 years forward, a PE of under 5. Investors often make the mistake of equating manager performance in a given year with manager skill. In some instances, more skilled managers will underperform because they refuse to participate in market bubbles. In fact, during market bubbles, the best performers are often the most imprudent rather than the most skilled managers. Taylor underperformed in 1999. Because he thought it was ridiculous to buy tech stocks at their inflated price levels. This same investment decision, however, was one of the key reasons why he strongly outperformed in subsequent years when these stocks experienced an extended slide. Chapter 11. Tom Klages. A Change of Plans. Thomas Klages had it all planned out. Financial security was very important. He would get a degree in practical science and an MBA, a set of credentials he felt would ensure a successful career. And that is just what he did. After receiving a degree in chemical engineering, Klages spent 2 years working in his chosen field, and then interrupted his working career to attend Harvard Business School. After receiving his MBA, Klages returned to his former company, Rohm & Haas, and worked his way up the corporate ladder. Within 15 years, he was manager of their European operations and thought to be in line to eventually become the firm's CEO. He had financial security. His career was on an upward trajectory. He loved his job and the people he worked with. It was all going exactly to plan, except Klages had another passion. He was also an avid stock investor who first became enticed by the stock market as a child. Klages adhered to a discipline of living only on one-third of his income and investing the remainder. Through a combination of strong performance and the additional investment of his annual savings, his stock account grew steadily over the years. Eventually, Klages found that he was earning more money from the stock account than from his executive position in the chemical industry. He decided to abandon his successful career to become a portfolio manager. He said it was the most difficult decision he ever made. His second thoughts about his decision and the vacillation that followed led to great personal angst as described in the interview. Klages has realized a 17% average annual compounded net return over a 19-year period. His audited personal account did even better, compounding at 33% gross during the 7 years prior to the fund's launch. During the combined 26-year track record, Klages had 5 losing years. 2 of them were very modest, 3% or less. The only significant negative years were 1991, when his account was down 12%, 2008 when the fund lost 25%, and 2011 when the fund was down nearly 9%. In each case, the subsequent year's gain more than doubled the loss, excluding 2011, for which the following year's return is unknown at this writing. For example, following the dismal 2008 performance, the fund was up 56% in 2009, its best year ever. Klages is a natural contrarian. He often lags badly when others are making easy money and soars when others are panicking. This mirror image investing experience was clearly evident in the final year of the tech bubble, 1999, and its aftermath. Klages actually had a small loss in 1999 when the S&P 500 was up 21%, but then scored large gains during the major bear market of 2000 to 2002. The one glaring exception in avoiding poor performance in a bear market was the financial meltdown of 2008, when Klages lost money along with most everyone else. Even when Klages is doing well during strong equity market years, the source of profits may be counterintuitive. As a case in point, Claugus achieved an 18% annual compounded return during the 1990s, his fund launched in 1993, not by riding the steadily rising tide of stock prices, but by being net short throughout the period. Claugus's highly differentiated exposure levels, vis-a-vis most equity hedge funds, have been one of the characteristics, besides solid long-term returns, that have attracted investors, particularly those managing multi-fund portfolios. Claugus's hedge fund company, GMT, currently manages $5.0 billion in its onshore and offshore Bay Resource funds. Claugus is based in Atlanta, where I met him a decade earlier when giving a talk to a regional hedge fund group. I interviewed Claugus when he came to New York City to attend a conference. We met after the day's sessions were complete and found an empty meeting room where we could talk in relative privacy. We were periodically interrupted by a security guard, who first came by to see who we were, and then returned intermittently to see when we would be leaving.
When did you first get interested in the stock market?
My father invested in stocks. As a young boy, I saw my father check the stock quote page of the paper every day. I was curious what he was doing, so I asked him about it. I thought I bought my first stocks when I was 9 years old.
How does a 9-year-old have money to buy stocks?
I had a paper route. One of my parents opened a custodian account for me.
Did your father help you pick stocks to buy?
No, he gave me an S&P stock guide. I leafed through it and found two local companies I recognized, Wheeling Pittsburgh Steel and McCrory, which was a five-and-dime chain store, so I bought them. Both companies eventually went bankrupt. I made a little money on Wheeling Pittsburgh Steel, but I held McCrory into bankruptcy. My father was a product of the Depression, and he was scared to death of being poor again. Somehow, I don't know how he did it, he transferred that insecurity to me. From a very early age, I knew I wanted to be financially independent. That was very important to me. I remember when I was a freshman in college, I put together a 30-year financial plan outlining how I could save and invest my money. I calculated that by saving 2/3 of my income and earning 10% a year on my investments, I could be a millionaire by the time I was 53. The reason I picked chemical engineering was that I was good at math and chemistry, and engineering paid well. It was as simple as that. My whole goal was to make $12,000 a year. I almost switched to business several times during college.
Why didn't you?
I came from a family with a science background. My father was a veterinarian, one of his brothers was a heart surgeon, and the other brother was an engineer. It was sort of expected that I would major in science or engineering. Business was considered too easy. But I wasn't a very good engineer. I did well academically because I was dedicated and worked extremely hard. My father also scared me to death about how important it was to do well in school. When I went to college, he said, "Tom, you're going to feel like you're going to jail. You can go out Friday night or Saturday night, but you can't go out both, or else you won't get ahead." I really had in my mind that at some point I would study business. My plan was that I would get an MBA. I thought that if I could get both a chemical engineering degree and a business degree, then I could be a manager in a chemical company. After my first 2 years of work, I decided to go to business school. I applied and got into Harvard. I got the impression from most of my classmates that their families were elated when they got into Harvard Business School. My father, however, was not happy at all when I got accepted. I was not even sure that I was going to go. Then word got out at my company that I had been accepted to Harvard Business School, and one of the vice presidents called and asked me out to lunch. I thought, this guy never even acknowledged my existence, and now he calls to take me out to lunch just because I was accepted. Maybe I should go to this place after all.
Your father was an educated guy. He was a veterinarian. Why was he so negative on your going to Harvard?
He was upset that I was leaving a job that was paying $15,800 to go back to school. My father was a very tough guy. He didn't start undergrad until his mid-20s because he felt he had to stay home, work the family farm, take care of his mother. My father measured almost everything in terms of money. During the summers, I would help my father on the farm, cutting timber and doing other stuff. He would take me down through the woods and teach me about trees. We came across this magnificent walnut tree. My father said with admiration, "Isn't this a beautiful tree? It's probably worth $3,000.
Not counting your dabbling with stocks as a child, When did you start investing in the stock market?
I never wanted to depend on my job for money, so I started investing from day one. From the start, I tried to give myself motivation to save money. My plan was to live on 1/3 of my income plus 3% of my net worth. The 3% of my net worth figure was based on the assumption that I could earn at least 10% a year. So effectively, my plan was to live on 1/3 of all income.
When did you go from being a long-only investor to incorporating shorting as a key component of your investment strategy?
In 1986, I became concerned that the market was overpriced. I like risk. I like the excitement of being in the market. I knew I didn't have the discipline to stay out of the market, and I felt the stocks were too expensive, so I started shorting.
When in 1986?
In early 1986.
So you started shorting almost a year and a half too early. The market didn't peak until August 1987.
Yes, and a lot of times before the market cracks, the lower quality stocks zoom. I remember being on the tennis courts with my friends in the summer of 1987. He begins a tremulous laugh that betrays an undertone of pain. And I was losing so much money that I had to call my mother to get a loan to meet the margin call. She was the only one I could call. There was no way my dad would have loaned me the money.
Did you stay short all the way through until the crash?
I did.
So even though the market kept moving against you, you just...
I just hung in there.
You never second-guessed yourself?
Sure I did. In fact, when I was playing tennis that day, I told my buddies that I was a failure and that I was going to lose all my money.
You were short during the crash of October 19th, 1987. What stands out in your memory about that day?
As the market was crashing, I thought I could start putting on some longs to reduce my net short position. The trade I remember most is putting in an order to buy Mead paper at 32, and I got a fill at 27. The market was collapsing that quickly.
Did you cover any of your shorts during the market freefall?
I don't believe I covered much because most of the stocks I was short were low quality, and I didn't think there was a need to cover them quickly. Instead of covering shorts, I started buying stocks that I really liked.
But some of the stocks you were short must have been down by 30% or more that day.
I was short these fly-by-night companies, some of which were probably manipulated. I think there were only two stocks that were up on October 19, 1987, and I was short one of them. It eventually cratered. I've always tried to be long and short in things that I really believed in for the longer term, situations in which I felt that the fundamental underpinnings of the company were completely different from the way it was being priced.
In 1987, you went from margin calls to windfall profits. Did the 1987 experience influence you in any way?
1987 was the first year I made more money in the market than I did in my job. That was an eye-opener for me. And every year after that, I made more money in the market than in my job.
How do you go from a career as a chemical engineer and the manager of European operations for a chemical company to being a portfolio manager?
If you had asked me a year before I left Roman Haas whether I would ever leave, I would have told you that I was there for the duration. My aspiration was to be CEO of Roman Haas. The reason I had been investing in the stock market up to that point was that I liked risk-taking, and I wanted to be financially independent. I knew I couldn't reach my financial goals on my salary. I was cruising along a pretty good path, my investments were working for me, and I was making more money on them than in my job. My net worth reached $1.6 million. I thought 3% of $1.6 million is $48,000. I could live on that. Once I had that realization, all of a sudden the economic necessity to keep on working went away. Until that point, every time I asked myself, when are you going to do what you want to do, the answer would always be later. Did I really want to live in Philadelphia, which is where Roman Haas was located? Not really. The realization that I had the economic freedom to sustain a business for 3 to 5 years totally turned me upside down. I spent a year in terrible turmoil.
Turmoil in trying to decide what you wanted to do?
Yes, ultimately I decided to manage money like I managed my own money. I started a hedge fund in 1990 with $3 million. Part of it was mine and the rest was from friends and family.
What was the experience like managing a fund for the first time? I went from regional director in Europe with everyone telling me how smart I was to managing a portfolio by myself out of my home. I felt a very low sense of self-worth. After 9 months of this, I said to myself, Claugus, you are a people person. You made a big mistake.
What convinced you that you had made a mistake?
I think it was the loneliness. I had spent 17 years at Roman Haas. I missed my friends.
How had you done in terms of performance in those first 9 months of managing the fund?
I was up in the first 6 months, but then I started giving money back. I think I was still up a little bit when I started to seriously question my decision to manage a fund. Once I was unsure about what I wanted to do, I was afraid that if I continued on and lost money, I would feel a responsibility to make up the difference to my investors, and by reimbursing them, I could lose all the money I had saved up during the past 14 years.
Did you discover that managing money was different from what you had perceived it to be?
The responsibility of having other people's money really weighed on me. If you have a 10-year time horizon, you can make good decisions and make a lot of money. If you have a 3-year time horizon, you could probably still do well. But if you have only a 3-month time horizon, anything can happen.
Why did you think there was a 3-month time horizon?
Because I started doubting whether I would continue.
Did you close the fund?
I did. I closed it at the end of the first year.
What finally prompted you to close the fund?
I had talked to my friends about how I felt. Roman Haas heard that I was unhappy being on my own and offered me a job. I decided to take the offer and close my fund.
How did you feel when you closed the fund?
Here's the most startling thing for me. I got the offer letter from Roman Haas around Christmas time. I'll never forget the sinking feeling I had when I read the letter. It was an offer to be regional director of Asia based in Hong Kong. I really had no desire to go to Asia.
Hadn't you discussed the details of your job before accepting the offer to come back?
I hadn't up to that point. They had basically said they would bring me back into a key job and that I would possibly still be in line to become CEO of Roman Haas. Basically, they desperately needed someone good in Asia. No one else who was qualified wanted to go. Their attitude was, Tom wants to come back, perfect, he has to earn his way back, and we'll send him to Asia. It will be well perceived by the organization. For them, it was very clear. I walked out to put the for sale sign in front of my house, and I just couldn't do it. One of my sons was a great gymnast. He was a state champion. So one of my concerns was, where would my kids do their athletics? I had this terrible feeling about it. So I called the CEO of Roman Haas and said, do you mind if I go to Hong Kong and check it out first? He said, sure, go to Hong Kong. When I was at the airport in line for the flight, I was still not sure that I wanted to go. So I got out of line. Then I got back in line and then back out again. I finally got on the plane.
What was your impression of Hong Kong?
Very crowded. I offered to donate a trampoline to the school and they said they didn't have room for it.
He laughs for a long time at this recollection.
I wasn't wild about it, but I decided I would go anyway. I tried to get myself psyched about going, but I just couldn't do it. I decided I needed to go back to Hong Kong and check it out again. It was a replay of my first visit, and I spent 5 months trying to get myself to go to Hong Kong. I became depressed, and I lost 45 pounds.
Boy, you really didn't want this job.
This was the first time in my life that I decided to do something mentally that was in conflict with my emotions. My body just stopped me in my tracks. I didn't realize it, but there was no way I could go to Hong Kong. Roman Haas had a coach who did assessments of managers to see if they had the right profile to be CEO. During this period, she was talking to me on the phone and asking me a number of questions. She said, Tom, I think you are clinically depressed. You need to see a psychiatrist. You need to do it right away. She found me a doctor who placed me on antidepressants. Finally, I went to Roman Haas. I was probably down to about 135 pounds by that time, and I looked like death. And I told them that I couldn't take the job in Hong Kong.
When did you come out of your depression?
Very quickly after I turned the job down.
That did it?
That plus the antidepressants. I had a friend who had gone through depression, and as soon as he realized that I was going through depression myself, he gave me advice. He said, look, Tom, here's what you have to do.
I went through all this counseling, and all I can tell you is just get the drugs. After I'd taken the antidepressant for about 2 weeks, the cloud lifted and I could see again.
Was that the only episode of depression you had?
The only one.
Why do you think you had become clinically depressed? Was it primarily a matter of having to relocate to a place where you didn't want to go?
What put me into clinical depression was trying to force myself to go to Hong Kong when I didn't want to do it. But I didn't know for sure why I didn't want to do it.
What do you think now was the reason?
It was because I was giving up on my dream. In my heart, I really wanted to be on my own, and I hadn't taken it to completion.
Did you learn something from that whole experience?
Yes, it taught me the importance of having your emotional side lined up with your mental side for life-changing decisions.
What did you do after you turned down the job at Roman Haas?
I decided that my original plan to start a hedge fund was what I really wanted to do.
When did you start a new hedge fund?
In January 1993.
That is about a year and a half after you turned down the Roman Haas job. Why did you wait so long?
After my uncertainty the first time, I wanted to be sure of my decision the second time.
What about your concern about managing other people's money?
If I am 100% dedicated to managing your money, and I lose your money, I can look you in the eye and say I did my best, and I could be okay with that. If I am not 100% engaged, however, and I'm not even sure I want to be in the business, then managing other people's money is very hard. Once I was sure I wanted to manage money, it took away 80% of the angst. It is the same reason we don't put up gates. We had huge outflows in 2008 because we didn't have gates. Sure, I would have preferred to reduce investor withdrawals, and as it turned out, investors would have been far better off if they didn't redeem in 2008. People do things that are not in their best interest. But there is a big difference between their making their own decision and my telling them what is in their best interest. If investors want to redeem, and I say they can't because there is a gate, and then I lose their money, that is a way different feeling than losing money for investors who have reached their own decision to stay in the fund.
How did you find the experience of working alone the second time around?
I enjoyed it.
What changed?
Just time. I got used to working alone, and I love investing.
What is your investment philosophy?
I am a reversion to the mean thinker. We use standard deviation bands to define extreme readings. For example, here is a chart of the S&P based on data going back to 1932. I didn't want to use the run-up to the Depression and the early years of the Depression because I thought it would distort the data. Using a 95% confidence band, the low is currently 895 and the high is at 2522. The argument is that you would have your maximum long position at the lower band and your maximum short position at the upper band.
But obviously there are times when you can stay beyond the bands for a long period.
That's where we will lose money. For example, here is the tech bubble when we were net short and the market kept going up.
How would your exposure vary based on the market's position relative to the extreme bands?
At the lower band, we would be 130% long and 20% short. At the midpoint, we would be 100% long and 50% short. We are 50% net long at the midpoint rather than neutral because of the long-term secular uptrend in stock prices. At the upper band, we would be 90% short and 20% long, or 70% net short. Our net exposure will increase as the market goes down and decrease as the market goes up. We do similar calculations using the NASDAQ and the Russell 2000 indexes, and then derive a composite target exposure based on the relation between current prices and the price bands in all three indexes.
What are the other elements of your investment approach besides a reversion to the mean adjustment in your portfolio net exposure?
After determining the portfolio net exposure, we do a similar analysis by sector, trying to identify sectors that are cheap and sectors that are expensive.
I assume that you favor longs in sectors that are cheap and shorts in sectors that are expensive. Are there exceptions?
All the time. The relative valuations are only a guideline. It is critical to also examine the specific fundamentals. For example, Brazil may show up as being expensive, but the fundamentals are very good, so I don't want to be short. The next part of our analysis is figuring out why a sector or stock is expensive or cheap, and do we see something that is going to change that? That is where we spend 90% of our time. I look for anomalies. When I screen quarterly earnings, I look for quarterly earnings that are up more than 50% or down more than 30%. For example, recently the earnings for Rock 10, a paper company, were up huge, so I tried to figure out why.
What was the reason?
The paper stocks had been cheap for 4 or 5 years. I had been looking for a reason to buy them, but it is not a great business, and I couldn't come up with one. But over time, there were two things that had happened. First, no one had built any capacity for years because the business was so bad. Second, there was consolidation. As a result of these factors, there was an inflection point. The pricing power had shifted in favor of the suppliers. It is easier to turn down business when capacity is running at over 90% than when it is running at 60%. I didn't necessarily want to own paper companies long term, but I wanted to own them then. That is why we bought Rock 10.
What happened with that position?
We still hold it, although we have traded around the position. It is up over 50% from where we originally bought it.
With the security guard coming in with increasing frequency and Cloud is tired after a long day, we decided we would continue our interview the next day. I met Cloud the following day at the conference during lunch break. Against my better judgment and prior experience, I agreed to continue our conversation over lunch in the hotel restaurant, which grew steadily noisier as the interview progressed. Deciphering the resulting taped conversation through the background din was a job worthy of the FBI. After repeated listenings with the sound turned up to uncomfortably loud levels, I was able to make out most of our conversation. It is the absolute last time I ever do an interview over a meal. I checked your net exposures and was surprised to see that you were only modestly short near the end of the tech bubble. Wouldn't your long-term valuation model have indicated a more decisive net short position at that juncture? Surely the market must have been near the upper part of the valuation range at that point.
We were supposed to be more heavily net short. Our target exposure for the fourth quarter of 1999 was 70% net short. However, we were losing money so fast that we had to back off our position. Every day I would come in and we would be down another 1%. I got to the point where I said, I may be right, but I have to shrink the portfolio. What I did was that for every 1% the portfolio lost, I reduced the exposure by 2%. As a result, instead of being 70% short, we went into the fourth quarter of 1999 at 70% short and 50% long, or only 20% net short. I thought I might replace some of the shorts once the market broke, but I didn't have the guts. I have people tell me all the time that I should short stocks after they break. All I can tell you is that if you didn't short the stock when it was 80, psychologically it's very difficult to sell it when it's 50.
Do you have specific risk management rules?
For many people, risk control means that they have a plan for what they will do if something goes very wrong. I try to avoid getting into that situation in the first place. Our defining moment of a survival threat is being down more than 7% in a month and not knowing why. If you look at the history of our fund, you will find that 90% of the monthly returns were between plus 7% and minus 7%. So as long as a monthly loss is less than 7%, we are still in a normal range. If a loss exceeds 7%, it indicates that something is wrong. If I can figure out what is wrong, then I might not change anything. If I can't figure out what is wrong, then I'll have to reduce the exposure.
So once you are down 7% for the month, you just play defense?
No, not necessarily. We were down big in September 2008. I started taking off exposure, but I was selling stock at what I considered ridiculous prices. It just felt wrong, so I stopped. Losing money on the long side is different from losing it on the short side.
Because on the long side there is a limit to how low prices can go, but on the short side the risk is open-ended.
It's not only that. It's also different from the client's perspective. During the fourth quarter of 1999, when the market was skyrocketing and I was net short, I was losing my ass at the same time most other hedge funds were making a ton of money. When your investors look around, and you're losing money, while everyone else is making money, they are much more likely to pull their investment. Being short in a rising market is very difficult from an investor relations standpoint. In 2008, we were losing money, but so was everyone else. It's a lot easier to keep your capital base in that type of scenario.
It sounds like your risk management process is very discretionary. It depends on your trusting yourself to act when losses are beginning to get more extreme than usual.
Yes, it is very hard. We spend a lot of effort to avoid getting into that type of situation in the first place. You want to design a portfolio that will survive a 150-foot tidal wave. The number one risk factor for me is leverage. At the extreme levels, our net exposure is usually less than the net exposure of a typical mutual fund. One of the reasons I didn't take more exposure off in 2008 was that I was only about 75% net long. Virtually every mutual fund on the planet is close to 100% long. So what is the big deal?
With the benefit of hindsight, do you believe that you made any mistakes in 1999?
I did make one change to the process because of the 1999 experience. I previously used a 90% confidence interval to determine the extremes at which I would go to a maximum net long or short position in the portfolio. As a result of the 1999 experience, I widened the band to 95%. Part of the judgment factor is how much risk you want to take at the extremes because the market can't keep going. The problem I had in 1999 was that I went to a maximum short position too early. But in terms of stock selection, I don't think we did anything wrong. At the start of 2000, I was trying to figure out what went wrong in 1999. I have what I call my Evel Knievel screen. These are companies that are trying to jump the Grand Canyon and probably won't make it. There are only two conditions for the screen. First, the company is trading at more than 5 times book value. Second, the company is losing money. My job is to figure out which stocks won't make it across the Grand Canyon and then go short these stocks. At the time, the internet business model was to get share on the net. It didn't make any difference how much money you lost doing it, as long as you increased your share. In fact, if you lost a lot of money, it meant you were being aggressive. Normally, when I do my Evel Knievel screen, I get maybe 60 or so companies. At the end of 1999, I had 180 names. And out of these 180 names, about 2/3 of them had doubled in price during the prior quarter. I thought to myself, there is nothing you can do. These are the best shorts on the planet. I ultimately concluded that I would go short those types of stocks again because 99 times out of 100, I am going to make money. So it would be wrong for me to change my approach because of the 1999 experience.
So you concluded that you didn't really do anything wrong.
That's right. Just because you made money doesn't mean you were right, and just because you lost money doesn't mean you were wrong. It's all a matter of probabilities. If you take a bet that has an 80% probability of winning and you lose, it doesn't mean it was a wrong choice.
I totally agree. A big mistake investors make is that they judge whether a decision was right based solely on the outcome. There is a lot of randomness in the outcome. The same set of conditions can lead to different outcomes. If you play 2008 all over again, the same set of initial conditions would sometimes lead to the market bottoming sooner and sometimes lead to a depression. My take on it is that whether a trading decision was right or wrong is not a matter of whether you won or lost, but rather whether you would make the same decision all over again if faced with the same facts, assuming you have a profitable process. 2008 was the first time you had a significant loss at the same time the equity markets and other hedge fund managers were down sharply. What was different in 2008?
It all goes back to our net exposure indicator. If the current indicator value is in the lower quartile, that is, price valuations are low, we will be significantly long. If the market then drops sharply, we will lose money just like everyone else. If, however, the market breaks sharply when the indicator is in the upper quartile, then we will significantly outperform.
I noticed that you were net short for most of the bull market of the late 1990s, and yet you did very well. How did you manage to achieve strong returns being net short in a sharply rising market?
Stock pricing.
When the market sells off really hard, as happened in late 2008 to early 2009, it is usually a matter of liquidity. There is no place to hide in a liquidity sell-off. People sell everything because they have to, not because they want to. The reverse rarely happens on the upside. People don't run out and buy everything. There are always some stocks that are going down. The interesting thing is that shorts are actually easier to find than longs. It is easier to spot a broken company than a good company. It is easier to identify bad management than good management. In September 2001, about 9 months after I had interviewed Klaugas, I called him with additional questions. You are currently 85% net long. That seems to be a relatively high long exposure given the current concerns about the U.S. economy and the stability of the European Union. What makes you so bullish?
The net exposure is primarily determined by the mean reversion model, but I don't think the economy is as bad as the media is portraying it. We track a number of basic indicators to get a feel for the real economy. For example, rail traffic is up 2% for the year and truck traffic is up 4%, which are not figures indicative of a contraction. Load factors on airlines are pretty good as well. RevPAR, revenue per available room, for hotels is up 7%. These are basic indicators you can look at that tell you the economy is just not that bad. Although we still have to work through some of the housing bubble excess, I don't expect construction of housing starts to fall much from here because they are already so low they have almost nowhere to go but up.
That's the most optimistic assessment I've heard about the U.S. economy from anyone.
I wouldn't say I'm optimistic. If you look at the current numbers, I think it's very difficult to argue that the U.S. economy is in trouble. But if you look at the budget and the trade deficits and government spending, the situation is out of control. We clearly need to rein in government spending, and when that happens, it is likely to slow the economy. It is like a household that has been living off their credit cards and has to start paying back their debts.
So even though the current economy may be okay, if we have this contraction looming, doesn't that act as a counterbalance to your bullish argument?
Exactly, and that is why I brought it up. Here I am fairly long stocks, and if I look over my shoulder, I see this huge storm cloud, and I don't know when it is going to hit. It could be in 6 months, it could be in 6 years. In Europe, the markets are already disciplining the governments. Eventually the same thing will happen in the U.S. if we don't take actions beforehand. And so far the politicians have shown no ability to either cut costs or raise revenues in anticipation of the growing debt problem. Politicians only respond to a crisis when they have someone to blame, either the market or the bankers or anybody but themselves, and then they will act. The Western world has a huge debt problem and is managing it very poorly.
So where does that leave you? On the one hand, you have all these indicators that tell you the economy is better than most people think it is, while on the other hand, you have the storm cloud that when it hits will presumably take the market down sharply, at least initially.
We are trying to focus on industries and companies that will do okay, regardless of the economy, and on international economies that we expect will continue to do well.
What kind of companies would be more immune to a contraction in the economy?
Companies that offer solutions to problems. One example is Celanese. They are working on a process to produce ethanol from natural gas at much lower costs. If they can take cheap natural gas and turn it into ethanol and undercut the current price of ethanol, and possibly even gasoline, they would be able to capture a share of the huge fuel market, regardless of what the economy is doing.
Which countries are you focusing on that you believe have the best long-term prospects?
China is one, but with the caveat that centrally run economies generally don't do well. We like Indonesia. 15 years ago, they were a basket case, but now they have a sound budget, exports are growing, and the economy has been doing well for several years. We also like Brazil, Singapore, and Colombia.
Colombia? That is not one I would have expected on the list.
10 years ago, you couldn't drill a well in Colombia because you would get shot. The FARC was all over the place. Now the government will actually base military personnel at drilling operations. The Putumayo Basin is largely unexplored because people couldn't get in there before the last 4 or 5 years. In the past 3 years, Colombia's oil production has shot up from 600,000 barrels per day to 950,000 barrels per day, and I think it will continue to grow rapidly. The same thing is true for other industries as well, such as agriculture. The changed security situation in Colombia is sparking a complete rebirth of the Colombian economy.
What percent of your portfolio is in emerging markets versus developed countries?
Right now, it's about 30% and growing, which is as high as it has ever been.
How do you pick stocks? Can you provide an example that illustrates your thinking process?
I can use one of our current largest positions, which is United Airlines, as an example. The conventional wisdom is that airlines are a terrible investment and that you never want to own them. In fact, Warren Buffett says that he has a full-time employee whose only job is to keep him from ever buying another airline again.
My son has a similar line. He asked, how do you become a millionaire? Answer, start with a billion and buy an airline. There are many reasons why airlines are widely considered to be poor investments. They are capital-intensive, they are people-intensive, they are difficult to manage, they have to rely on an inefficient government air traffic control system,